Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening. Who are tuned in? We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe, O. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everybody. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. As a reminder, we started the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of 2013 as a call for an emergency in the Black community. And since then, we meet every Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The number to be a part of those conference calls is area code 712-432-1500. 800-600 access code 220-981 pound. Again, every Sunday we have a weekly conference call where we catch up and talk about things that are going on in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our states, and across the nation, and even throughout the diaspora. We were actually on the line with just about four or five of us on Sunday for over 2 hours just talking about the state our state is in. Please call in. Please share with us what your thoughts are, what you think the UAC could and should be doing, and any let us know of any potential resources or partnerships that are out there that we may be missing. Again, the number to dial in is area code 712-432-1500, access code 220-981 pound at 6:30 every Sunday, come rain or come shine or snow even, as we had in this past Sunday, we will be there and ready to engage you. So we also would like to ask that you please make your $10 monthly donation to Sign of the Times via our PayPal account. The email address for our PayPal is signothetimes19@gmail.com. signothetimes19@gmail.com. Or you can mail those to us at Sign of the Times, 421 West McNicken Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45214. The number to dial in to participate in tonight's Blog Talk broadcast is area code 917-889-8059, and you simply push 1 and you can be a part of the conversation. And so tonight is Tuesday, and every Tuesday we have with us Dr. James Jones. Peace, Dr. Jones. How you doing tonight?
I'm great, Queen. How you doing, please?
I'm much better.
Much better.
That's all I can say. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm trying to I don't know what was going on with me yesterday health-wise, so I think I threw up like 15 times in the morning in like 2 hours, but nothing came up. I don't know. So I'm feeling better today, so we'll see. We'll see. I hope it ain't the job I'm allergic to or whatever. So
that's okay, because we're going to be able to write our own checks in a minute, Dr. Jones. This thing's going to pick up, and we're going to just travel around the country just, you know, like superheroes, like Sister Nakomo said when she was on the air. You know, we're going to be a bunch of superheroes going around to different urban communities and holding hands with folks and telling them that we love them. How about that?
All right. That sounds good to me.
So tonight, what's on our plate for tonight?
You know, thought we would deal with an issue that is always prevalent within our community. It's one of them that really since our moment of arriving here under European control has been an issue, and it is the after effects of African-American families being disrupted through a host of methods. During the institution of chattel slavery, it was certainly the pernicious way that our families would be destroyed by people being sold off and what have you. I don't know if you caught any of the BET series, The Book of Negroes. We had a situation there where a enslaved woman was actually had her child taken away and sold. Then it was that today we're looking at the economic changes that caused some people to not only some to abort their children, and we know that that's an issue within the African American community, but also having others who put their children up for adoption. And the question that has dogged us from, as I said, the moment of chattel slavery to this very moment is, what about the children? What happens to these children? And we recently had a house dealing with this issue titled Black or White. And the contemporary issue that we're facing is a question that's been with us for a while now. And that question is, are black children who are in the foster care system waiting to be adopted or what have you, are they better off remaining within that system when African Americans do not step up, and it's historically an anomaly that we don't step up, because during the slave experience, of course, we took whoever in. But what happens with a child when an African American doesn't step up and people of another nationality step forward and give them a home? Is that a raiding of the African American community? Do these children have any semblance of understanding of African American culture or history? So it's an interesting issue that I thought we might do well by discussing it tonight.
That sounds good. Do you mind if I read the movie intro on what black and white is?
Oh, go right ahead.
Okay, it says movie info. Black or White is the story of a grandfather, Academy Award winner Kevin Costner, who is suddenly left to care for his beloved granddaughter. When her paternal grandmother, Academy Award winner Octavia Spencer, seeks custody with the help of her brother, Anthony Mackie, the little girl is torn between two families who love her deeply with the best intentions at heart. Both families fight for what they feel is right, and are soon forced to confront their true feelings about race.
Yes, ma'am. That's a good summary of it. I won't deal with the movie, because the movie was it was an interesting portrayal, and I'll just say it that way. It was a very interesting portrayal of a lot of things dealing with our community.
Mm-hmm.
So, So if you want to just jump into it, we can go ahead and jump into it and see where this discussion leads us.
All right. Well, the term for interracial adoption is now called transracial adoption. The term transracial adoption means the joining of racially different parents and children together in adoptive families. It says, what legislation exists concerning transracial adoption? It says the Howard M. Metzenbaum Multi-Ethnic Placement Act of 1994 prohibits an agency or entity that receives federal assistance and is involved in adoptive or foster care placements from delaying or denying the placement of a child on the basis of the race, color, or national origin of the adoptive or foster parent or the child involved. In 1996, Congress enacted a law amending MEPA, Inter-Ethnic Adoption Provision, which forbids agencies from denying or delaying placement of a child for adoption solely on the basis of race or national origin. The provisions remove potentially misleading language stated that discrimination is not to be tolerated, strengthens compliance and enforcement procedures, including the withholding of federal funds and the right of a grieved individual to seek relief in federal court against the state or other entity alleged to be in violation of the act. So this looks as though even if a child is better placed with a family member, are they saying in this act, do you think that they still can't deny the potential placement with somebody who's outside the family?
Yeah. It's an interesting issue that's been dogging Black America for a while. Unfortunately, we behaved as if it doesn't exist. The issue doesn't exist, but in actuality, it's right there in our face, and we have to deal with it. One of the things that I told you, my quote unquote side job that I have to do, I write for African American news papers, and I wrote a piece dealing with this issue for one of the papers that we can go ahead and use to kind of frame, because we actually have a Black social work agency that's been dealing with it for quite some time. So if you want to jump into the piece, we can jump into the piece and sort of flow from there.
Sounds good. Let's go.
Okay. The piece is titled Black or White, It Really Does Matter. And it reads as such: as a person who writes about the convergence of race, identity, and culture, I knew that I needed to view the movie Black or White because it revolved around these polarizing issues. For those who have not seen Black or White, it revolves around a young African-American child named Eloise being raised by her alcoholic white grandfather. The crux of the story is that the black side of Eloise's family, headed by Rowena, desires, played by Octavia Spencer, desires to obtain full custody of her on behalf of her drug-addicted son, Reggie. Black or White, albeit entertaining, makes its most important contribution in the innumerable issues that it raises regarding transracial adoptions. Transracial adoptions, particularly when involving African-American children and white parents, is nothing new. In fact, it was such a pressing problem in the early 70s that the National Association of Black Social Workers addressed the matter in what critics charged was a too strident manner that offended many. The National Association of Black Social Workers stated that as a result of transracial adoptions, children are far too often cut off from their culture of origin and their African ancestry is deemed unimportant. Two, it is our belief that until the inequity and discriminatory treatment of people of African ancestry is resolved, then the child welfare system will continue to treat our children and families with disparity. Three, the organization has always maintained the importance of finding culturally grounded options for children of African ancestry before giving consideration to placing our children outside of the community. This position that included a charge of genocide was recently revisited in the National Association of Black Social Workers created document, Preserving African American Families. The organization used the periodical to publicly reiterate its commitment to A, stop unnecessary out-of-home placements, B, reunification of children with parents, C, placing children of African ancestry with relatives or unrelated families of the same race and culture for adoption, D, addressing the barriers that prevent or discourage persons of African ancestry from adopting, E, promoting culturally relevant agency practices, and F, emphasizing that transracial adoption of an African-American child should only be considered after documented evidence of unsuccessful same-race placements has been reviewed and supported by appropriate representatives of the African-American community. Considering the reality that there are 463,000 American kids in the foster care system, 36,900 of the 123,000 children available for adoption are black. One of the most pressing problems facing this nation is the question of, are these children better off languishing in the American foster care system, or would they be better off with whites who have very little exposure to or understanding of African-American culture? This matter has proven to be a particularly polarizing issue for Americans of every hue. For example, the responses to a CNN story detailing Sandra Bullock's transracial adoption varied widely. One viewer related that, quote, white people adopt black kids to make themselves feel good. A black child needs black parents to raise it, end quote. While another chimed in and queried that, and I quote, maybe she, meaning Sandra Bullock, adopted one because the blacks in the community wouldn't step forward and adopt, end quote. It is impossible to draw a firm line regarding where the racial lineup regarding this, the racist lineup regarding this matter, as one commentator exasperatingly stated, and I quote, who cares what race they are? A woman got a child got a mother, it's beautiful. And yes, I am black, if it matters, end quote. A 2007 national survey relates that 40% of children adopted are of a different race slash culture from their adoptive parents. For many African Americans, it is the racial slash cultural differences between parent and child that are most unsettling. Most fear that white parents will totally ignore race. Chuck Johnson of the National Council for Adoption relates that such fears are founded, as there was this notion during the 70s and 80s that these parents need to be colorblind. This sounds wonderful, but by being colorblind, you're denying they're of a different race and culture. Johnson goes further to relate that such an approach is less than optimal and should be replaced by one that acknowledges race. Rita Simon, a professor of justice and public policy at American University, warns those seeking a transracial adoption to realize that, and I quote, love is not enough. You really have to make some changes in your life if you adopt a child of another race, end quote. Despite white protestations, it is impossible for the descendants of stolen and then enslaved Africans to encourage transracial adoptions without significant reservations. As with most racial matters, African Americans view contemporary issues through a historical lens colored by the memories of Jim Crow, lynching, segregation, discrimination, and racism. Such factors are the catalyst behind my skeptical view of transracial adoptions. As a historian, I fear that transracial adoptions will pave the way toward the further denigration, if not annihilation, of African Americans' cultural identity. This fear most certainly flows from historical occurrences that Khaled Abdul-Muhammad rhetorically reminded our community of when he stated, "Have you forgotten that once we were brought here, we were robbed of our name, robbed of our language, we lost our religion, our culture, our God, and many of us, by the way we act, we even lost our minds," end quote. It is the above historical context that makes me so cautious regarding transracial adoption. Considering all that persons of African descent have lost during their time in America, language, religion, culture, God, I would hope that the white community would have some compassion for our hesitation, if not resistance and hostility, to transracial adoption. Because when you add it up, we all that we got, and the cost of losing that is far too great of a risk. And I yield my mic, Queen.
Sherry, excellent piece, Dr. Jones. I'm going to go ahead and open up Miss Linda. She's been on the line since before we started, so I get her opinion on what we're talking about. Good evening, Miss Linda. Welcome to Sign of the Times. How are you?
I'm not. I was just listening to Dr. Jones, and I was glad to let you know. I had to get my sons up for adoption years ago. Because of the lifestyle that I was going through with my parents, and I didn't want the children to grow up. I figured it was best for me to give them up instead of for them to go through what I went through. and I've been trying my best to try to find my son. My daughter found me, but I can't find my son. So I've been able to explain the situation to them. I'm sorry for crying, okay? I'm sorry. You hear me? Hello? Hello?
Hello,
ma'am. Here.
I mean, you were saying, Dr. Jones, that, you know, really hit on, because that was, you know, like back in the 70s anyway. To be exact, it was back in 1975. Well, I had to get my boys up. Because I didn't want them to go through what I went through being abused child. I think that the church had to stop with me. I wanted to have something better.
Yes, ma'am. Hold on. Miss Linda, I'm gonna go to the screen room with you real quick. We're going to take a quick break. I'll be right there.
Well, I think to teach a man to hate himself is much more criminal than teaching him to hate someone else. And look at you. Who taught you to hate yourself?
Well, I got the books right here, and they're open to each and every brother's complete inspection. Get your hands off of that thing there. So you want to see the financial books, huh?
Yeah.
Well, there he is. There it is. You done see them. The meeting's adjourned.
What makes the so-called Negro unable to stand on his own two feet? He has no self-confidence. He has no proud confidence in his own race. Because the white man destroyed your and my past, destroyed our knowledge of our culture. And by having destroyed it, now we don't know we have any achievement, any accomplishment. And as long as you can be convinced that you never did anything, you can never do anything.
That is your papa talking to you now, Dice. Come on.
Okay. This is Queen Tahira. I'm back. Dr. Jones, you here? Dr. Jones, your mic is open. You here?
Yes, ma'am. I am here.
All right. All right. You know, it don't get no realer than that.
Most definitely. You know, it's one of those where that is a pain that we carry with us, and an issue that we carry with us that, for, you know, lack of a better way to even consider it, that is in many ways never resolved. You know, it's often never resolved. You know, so yeah. It brings up the question of with these children, are they
mm-hmm.
better off, or are they, you know what I'm saying, or should it be a
yeah.
you know it, there's no way of handling this issue, you know, and I think that's why it's so polarizing to people. It's quite simply that usually the decision is made under less than optimal standards, less than optimal moments in a person's life. And
mm-hmm.
once things become a little more regulated, it's we can't undo it usually, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what the National Association of Black Social Workers is advancing in their questioning is quite simply, do these children have, quote-unquote, rights or a voice in regards to what they will be raised up within, what type of rearing. Should the rearing that they receive be one that is predicated upon African-American culture? You know, and it really drives us to the larger question of, are these children, you know, is it exposure to culture that makes one African American, or is it something else? Is it
mm-hmm.
one's physical appearance? You know, what is it? What is it that puts this thing that we know, this divisive thing that we know is race, upon us?
Mm-hmm.
Can I yield my mic?
It's a tough decision, especially when you're looking at cases of abuse or rape or, you know, things like that. And, I mean, I think, you know, you want to give folks that are involved in industry the benefit of the doubt, so to say, that they're looking out for the best interest of the child. But you just really never know. It's almost as if you know, it's a roll of the dice. We all can think of stories where, you know, children were adopted and, you know, something tragic happened, but we can also think of stories where children were adopted and turned out to be phenomenal people. But yet and still, if we're looking at interracial adoption, that even comes with more, you know, of the questions of what ifs. And then you get into, transgender adoption, same-sex marriage adoption. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that this child that's just seeking a home can be spun. And I know here in the state of Ohio, even if a child is placed with a family member versus someone, you know, outside of the family, the person outside of the family actually gets more financial support and resources than a person who, you know, takes the child in who is blood related. So it's almost as if, you know, to a certain extent, the system is rewarded in that case for separating and disrupting and pulling apart the family further.
Most definitely. I mean, it's one of those issues that, you know, it puts you in that quandary and dilemma of the great saying of there is no right way to do the wrong thing. You make decisions, but there is no, quote unquote, necessarily right decision. There are a lot of wrong decisions, but there is no guarantee, you know, of if you place the child in this situation, what they'll end up experiencing and what have you. So, yeah, this is a tough one.
Now, I'm looking at some statistics I haven't quite found out yet as we're speaking. The number of, you know, African children who are in foster care compared to other races of children. But I did find something here. It says the most recent estimate of transracial adoption was performed in 1987 by the National Health Institute survey. The findings revealed that only 8% of all adoptions include parents of different races. 1% of white women adopt black children. 5% of white women adopt children of other races. 2% of women of other races adopt white children. And an estimated 15% of the 36,000 adoptions of foster care children in fiscal year 98 were transracial or transcultural adoptions, and that's according to the year 2000 DHS study. So, I mean, even this information is dated, and this was prior to the quote-unquote post-racial America, so I'm sure these numbers have gone up substantially since then.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we find is quite simply that even in this realm of adopting a child or providing love for a child, white babies are preferred over black children, over other races. It's just what it is. When you look at, remember the proliferation, I want to say it was Angelina Jolie that had adopted so many children from Africa and things like that. As a community, what does that mean for us? You know, what does that mean? You know, especially when you reflect, and this is one of the things that sticks in my craw. I watch to keep a barometer on many of the things that our people are embarking upon and experiencing. And one of the shows that is really almost a cultural signpost for me is Jerry Springer. No, Maury Povich. When I sit up and I watch the glee of African-American males to be told that they're not the father, you know, and the celebratory dances, the things like that. And it puts me in a saddened and almost introspective mood that when you really reflect upon what that means, that we don't even want our children anymore, you know, that we're living lives that are in every way telling black children that they don't matter, you know, and that is dastardly. That is disappointing. That is in every way heartbreaking. But I think that we're fooling ourselves when we sit up and we deny that's who we are and that's where we are right now. I had a very interesting weekend. I had my son this weekend, and he wanted to go into the Marvel superheroes. And so we're waiting to park, and, you know, we have to wait and watch all of these people walk across the road. Leaving. There was an earlier show, and then there was the show that we were going to. It was like a 12 o'clock and then a 3 or 4 o'clock show. And so we're waiting on these people to cross and basically move their cars so we could all park. And it was striking to me to see how many African-American women alone with their male sons that I saw, taking them to see the superheroes. And I can't remember, and I was paying very close attention, if I saw a single Mexican woman by herself with children taking them. And the white community, they were basically coupled up as well. It was only the black women that I saw. And I did see a few black couples, but predominantly, overwhelmingly, it was African-American women walking their sons to see this. And it puts you in the mind of, as a community, what does that mean? What does that mean about fatherhood? What does that mean about manhood? You know, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it makes me wonder, too, the difference is I always believed that I could raise my son, but I definitely knew I could not teach him how to be a man. And the older he got, the more and more I realized how much I could not teach him because I just did not have that experience. And so I'm wondering, do you think that that's similar when a woman is raising a son? Are the challenges, if you will, similar to people who are raising African children who are of, you know, another descent? Are those struggles still the same or are they totally different?
You know, I think that it's always different when you're talking about black in America. You get what I'm saying? I think that makes it different. Regardless of what it is that we're talking about, I believe that the fact that you're talking about black in America, I believe that makes it different. That always changes the rules, so to speak. So I would say that's different. But I think that what we're trying to articulate is quite simply the idea of the holes, those holes in that we can't cover, you know, that we flat out can't cover. And Du Bois talked about this idea of duality. The truth of the matter is that we have multiple identities running at the exact same time. And there are going to be holes. There are going to be holes for black men who are raising black men, you know. But I think that they're more pronounced when you're talking about raising children across racial lines, because quite simply, we can't prepare our children for the racism that they're going to confront. Lord knows that whites who have no idea of what this whole thing is about from our perspective, from our side of the desk, they're definitely not going to be able to prepare their children. But at the same time, one would have to think, especially when you're talking about wealthy whites, the privilege that these children are going to have, the ability to almost many ways play the game at a higher level, but they're going to bypass some of the things that me, that you and I and our children have had to deal with. Now you.
And so, Dr. Jones, we also have to ask ourselves the question, how are our children ending up in, you know, this kind of situation in foster care? We see a lot of, you know, what Brother Raj calls booty babies out here, folks, you know, just laying up and procreating, you know, without any a conscience for consequence. We've got, you know, drug abuse, you know, that could circumvent a child ending up in a foster care situation, if not several children, siblings. And we've got issues of abuse that often can lead a child being forced. So have you been able to find out where and how these children are ending up in the foster care system and, you know, where they're coming from, because there are a lot of them.
You know, it's one of the things that, and I often call upon this. This is the one moment that I utilize from any of his films, one of Tyler Perry's films. Don't remember the name of it. It's the one with the sister who was going to marry Blair Underwood, and he was beating her and what have you, whichever one that was. Tyler Perry was the lawyer in that movie, and his wife was apparently addicted to drugs, and one of her longtime friends who had been kicked out of her home, Elise Neal's character, I want to say, or Kimberly Elise, she comments to Madea, says, "What happened to her?" And Madea just looks at her and she says, "Life." And I think that that's enough of an explanation. I believe that we all have a peculiar story, but each of those stories is unique and has to in every way be looked at individually and singularly to get a larger, you know, because we can talk about drug abuse, but I guarantee you if we were to trace that person's story and look at it, that abuse came from somewhere. It might have been sexual abuse in the home, might have been verbal abuse. You know, it always has a stimulus, a catalyst to it, I guess I'm trying to say. So I think that it's just like, and I don't think that we give enough credit to how difficult it is to be black in America, to be poor in America, to be working paycheck to paycheck. And those are issues that know no racial bounds. So I think that these children end up in a host of ways. And you know, and the thing is that it is possible to get a social service agency involved for whatever reason. And people who are not able to defend themselves or their children can see their children being taken away. And they know little more than "I just want my children back." And that's how they will articulate it. And the system is going to be hellish upon them. It's not going to be because of maybe how they appear, maybe how they articulate, maybe the lack of enunciation of their words. The system is going to have no consideration for them or their children. And they're going to take them, they're going to put them somewhere, and they are gone. And so I think that life in general is the thing that we need to look at, what it's like to be in capitalist America, because it's not just black children that are in these. You know, as children of every race. There was an interesting story when I was researching the piece about I want to say she was in Michigan. She was an African-American woman who had, there was some relation between her, I want to say it may have been her son's daughter that she had taken in. She had adopted this little girl. And the little girl had a sister who was not her son's child. You get what I'm saying? The two girls had the same mother but different fathers, and her son was one of the fathers. And so she went to she wanted to adopt the fully white child, and it took her years for a court to agree to give her that child. And she talks about how difficult it was for her white child, for the white child, because so many people refused to recognize that she was not telling a story when she told the school that she had a black brother. You know, she had a younger brother who actually was quote-unquote fully 100% African-American. And that led to so many problems, even within the school system, that it was a truly amazing, absolutely amazing and riveting story, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, we're dealing with humans and we're dealing with, Lord knows, a court system that is wacky as can be on every given day, that Lord only knows what's going to come out of it, you know. So the question of, are these children better off in a family, a non-black family, than being stuck in that system? There's a part of me that kind of sides with yes, you know, but at the same time, I cringe because it says so much about our people and how somewhere along the way we lost that commitment to one another to take care of each other regardless of what it is. We become the monsters that our ancestors fought so hard against and fought to prevent from becoming. You know, in many ways, I think that the more that we become, quote-unquote, integrated in their worldview and their value system, the less, you know, it takes me back to Public Enemy's question of who stole the soul. And in many ways, I don't think anyone stole the soul. I believe that we willingly gave it away. And I yield.
Ashe, I did find a piece dated February 28th, 2013. It says the top five reasons that most kids end up in foster care. Number one is neglect. It says about 70% of the children who end up in foster care are there because of abuse or neglect. Two is physical abuse. Three is sexual abuse. It says sexual abuse is possibly the most horrifying of crimes to be perpetrated upon children. It is an extremely unfortunate but necessary reason to have the child removed from parental custody and placed in foster care immediately. Three is abandonment. And five is incapacitation of the parent, either due to medical reasons or being incarcerated. Dr. Jones, I, you know, actually had a group of children show up at my door at about 2 o'clock in the morning. This has been about 3 years ago. And mother was suffering from drug abuse and was allowing people to enter the bed with her children. And it was the most, I don't know, I've seen all kinds of stuff, like being in the hood and being down here as long as I have. I've seen people get hit by cars. I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff. But to have that happen, I did not know what to do. I had never experienced it before. And I love these children. The sister was in my Girl Scout troop, so we were quite close. We walked to school together every morning. I had no idea that this was going on. And so I'm sure that the oldest one, who was about 12 at the time, was the, you know, kind of ringleader, if you will, that decided to come knock on my door in the middle of the night simply because they couldn't take it anymore. And so I just didn't know what to do. I prayed about it at first because I just let them sit here at first, you know, and then I thought, you know, I cannot, like, not let their mom know where they are. But if I let their mother know where they are, am I putting them back at risk? So I ended up keeping them until the next day and taking them to school. But, you know, and we worked out something with the social worker to try to get them in some temporary care. But it was just a real odd position to be in. So, I'm curious from some of the callers, you know, do you have any input on what you might have done in that situation? And Dr. Jones, you know, did I handle that correctly, you think? Should I have gone to the school, or should I have just kept them here with me? You know, because I often wonder, because I hate putting the system in anything, that, especially if it involves us, you know. But it was like, I didn't know what else to do. So,
it's one of those decisions where, when you look at it and you deal with it and you weigh it, there really isn't a right way to do it. You know, what the human part of you says, which is quite simply, you have the urge and the love for these children to intercede immediately. But then there's that other part of you that is like, there's a protocol for this to, you know, to be dealt with. And I believe that you did both of them. You removed them from what could be termed the immediate danger, and yet at the same time you were able to, to get them long-term, short-term and long-term care and saving, you know. And what more could a person realistically expect of you? So I would say that you absolutely, you know, you were correct and appropriate in how you handled it, you know, because those situations have a tendency to, you know, for lack of a better term, just get completely out of hand, because you don't know if you could be accused of being a kidnapper. All types of things. You know, we all know that we've seen people who had the best intentions in the world get caught up in ways that, you know, they had no intention of getting caught up in,
mm-hmm.
you know, but they never like caught up in them, you know, so, and I yield.
Ashe. All right, the number to dial in is 917-889-8059. We're going to take a break at the top of the hour. I just want to share these statistics with you as far as wait time, too. When we talk about international adoption, it says Americans adopt children from Chile, Armenia, and India had the longest wait time, up to 2 years, for the adoption process to be completed. And adoptions were quickest in Madagascar, Estonia, and Panama. And these look like, it looks like the lighter the child, the longer it takes, you know, the lighter complexion of the child, the longer it takes for them to process the adoption. It says Madagascar has an average waiting time of 79 days, which is like a little over 3 months. But in Chile, they can wait up to 694 days. Estonia, 154, Panama, 166 days. And it looks like the, like I said, the highest is Chile at 694. And then you go to Argentina, India, Lithuania, and Mexico are all pretty long waiting times. But the other countries I mentioned are not. So do you think that ethnicity plays a part in the wait time that it takes to get some of these children, the darker the child, the easier it is for them to be picked up in adoption?
You know what, I would hate to think so, but I'm not naive enough to discount that, and I'll say it that way. I believe that people who, for whatever reason, are adopting these children are seeking children that have a sort of aesthetic look that they want, you know, that they want in their family. You know, I guess we could almost consider it to be a perverse playing out of the color complex that African Americans embark upon. You know, when we see black folk making less than optimal choices in their in whom they will seek to have a child with, I'll say it that way, based upon a person's skin color, hair texture, and things like that. So I put nothing past human beings and how silly they can be and what they will put their emphasis and extenuation upon. You know, I put nothing past them. Anything's possible.
Yeah, Ashe. I do too. And, you know, another thing that I noticed when there is cross-racial adoption is that a lot of times it appears that people who are of other ethnicities really don't know how to care for our children. They don't really know how to care for their hair. They don't know really how to care for their skin type. I mean, I've seen some children who are with, you know, obvious foster parents who look like they just roll out of bed every morning and throw fresh clothes on and hit the door. So how much are our children suffering because of the lack of, I guess, I don't know, proper ethnic experience, the cultural experience that we expose them to, you know, with these interracial adoptions?
Well, you know, I think that there's something to that, something to be said for that. But at the same time, if we balance it out with maybe those people are just, you know, obviously they're operating from a position of ignorance and unknowing. And that may be due to not caring or maybe just, you know, not having black folk in their circle or not knowing how to approach someone to ask them questions about that. And actually in the movie Black or White, you do have a scene where the white grandfather is trying to comb the his Eloise, his granddaughter's hair. And that emphasized and highlighted, you know, that issue right there. And it, you know, let's face facts. It is an issue of how you deal with certain things. There are certain hygienic things that are universal, but then there are some things that are peculiar to Europeans, some things that are peculiar to African Americans, and mm-hmm. you need to be able to address those and deal with those. But so often we don't see that that being really there being an opening for them to learn how to do that.
Mm-hmm. So should that be, you think, a part of the requirement that they go through some cultural awareness training? I mean, it seemed like that would be one of the things that would be on the list, the checklist of stuff, along with car and job and ability.
Yes, well, some agencies, and you know, to be fair to them, there are some agencies who do that. That's a part, you know, of how they prep these parents for what is getting ready to happen. You know, they actually have that as an integral component of the process. You know, but it's is it enough? Because really what you're talking about is developing a habit and being able to make that habit stick. And so the question is it enough? Is it enough? And that, I think that's the question that will dog everyone, you know, mm-hmm. throughout anyone involved in this process. And even though you're not involved in it actively, you're still somewhat involved in it. You know, so is it enough? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to read two more statistics real quick, and then we're going to take our break. And this is pertains to children worldwide. It says around the world, there are an estimated 153 million orphans who have lost one parent. There are 17,900,000 orphans who have lost both parents and are living in orphanages or on the streets, and the lack of care and attention required for healthy development. These children are at risk for disease, malnutrition, and death. And that report piece came from UNICEF. It says, this piece is different. It says, in the U.S., 397,122 children are living without permanent families in the foster care system. 101,666 of these children are eligible for adoption, but nearly 32% of these children will wait over 3 years in foster care before being adopted. So these are some very, very staggering statistics, y'all. And, you know, we say that we're out here, you know, working for the good of the community, working for the good of the children. So, you know, the more that we share this kind of information, I think the more it's going to put those of us who are in a position to speak on it, advocate for it, and actually, you know, encourage something to be done about it, I think the better off the children are going to be. So we're going to go ahead and take our break at the top of the hour. This is Queen Tahira Tuesdays with Dr. James Jones of Manhood, Race, and Culture. We'll be right back.
You're on your way. through the city going nowhere fast. You're on your own at last. Hey, it's getting late, where will you sleep?
Getting kind of hungry, but you forgot to bring something to eat.
Oh, lost the little money you tried to find. But remember, you left home only to be grown. So dry your weeping eyes. Little boys running away from home, and the parents don't see them no more. You wanna stop the hits and run a home, but your mama told you never trust a stranger, and you don't know which way to go. Streets are dark and deserted, not a sound, not a sign of life. Oh, how you long to hear your mother's voice, 'cause you're lost and alone. Remember, you made the choice.
Address to make that donation through our PayPal account is signothetimes19@gmail.com. Again, the email address for our PayPal account is signothetimes19@gmail.com. You also can choose to mail your donation in via regular postal service to Sign of the Times at 421 West McMinkin Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 452-1-4. Also, we want to remind you, Sundays at 6:30 Eastern, please join our weekly conference calls. The number to dial in is area code 712-432-1500, and the access code is 220-981-POUND. So welcome back, Dr. Jones. So in looking at, again, some of these statistics and things like that, I just want to read one more real quick, and then we can see if any callers want to push number one and join the conversation. It says, according to the U.S. Department, State Department, U.S. families adopted more than 7,000 children in 2012, which this came out in 2013. Americans adopted the highest number of children from China, followed by Ethiopia, Ukraine, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic of Congo. It seems like these are countries that have been in some sort of war. damn. As well, am I not saying that? I mean, is that right?
Yeah, it appears what you just read. Yeah, that was verified.
Wow. Okay, and this says no child under 3 years of age should be placed in institutional care without a parent or primary caregiver, according to research from the 32 European countries, including 9 in-depth country studies. which considered the risk of harm in terms of attachment disorder, developmental delay, and neural atrophy in the developing brain. Wow. Now, how many of these children are adopted at birth? Even though they may not end up in institutional care, they're still not with their birth parents. And even, you know, especially if they go into institutional care, with those years being the most formidable between 0 and 5, I mean, the statistic is shocking, but it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's one of the things that would drive home to us how whatever higher being that you believe in did not intend for this to be the path of development for children. You know, it's obvious that these children are not supposed to be away from their parents, from those who conceived them. You know, I would argue at all, but especially during those moments. That's, mm-hmm. You know, it's bordering on the level of even God couldn't conceive that. There is no adaptation for that.
I guess I'm kind of confused, though, by the statistic that said, well, maybe not, because if you consider the population rate, in looking at the 7,000 children that they say were adopted from China, Ethiopia, Ukraine, Haiti, and the Congo, population-wise, it would make sense why so many children would come from China. It doesn't have anything to do necessarily with, I guess, culture or anything with them. Does that sound right?
Because
they've got a really high population there.
Yeah, but I think that when you're speaking about China, you're speaking about a unique situation, and that situation is that they're only allowing them to, I believe, have one child. They have to stop at one if that child is a male, because they want apparently want males for military service and what have you. If the first child is a female, I believe that they're allowed to have a second child. But if that child comes out as a female, the child has to be put up for adoption. So that's one of their,
wow,
their means and their methods of population control.
Okay, so the next stat says children raised in orphanages have an IQ 20 points lower than their peers in foster care, according to a meta-analysis of 75 students, more than 3,800 children in 19 countries. It says in 2012, 23,396 youth aged out of the U.S. foster care system without the emotional and financial support necessary to succeed. Nearly 40% have been homeless or couch surfed. Nearly 60% of young men have been convicted of a crime, and only 48% were employed. 75% of women and 33% of men received government benefits to make basic ends meet. And 50% of all youth who aged out were involved in substance use, and 17% of the females were pregnant.
Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing that you said is from those stats would shock me. Because quite simply, when you really look at the amount and the level of support that we've needed all the way through our 20s from our parents, they don't get that, you know. And you're often so perilously close. And I'm not even talking about racially. I'm talking about as a person with limited financial resources, you're almost always perched on the edge of disaster financially. So if one thing occurs, such as a car breaking down, a flat tire, hell, needing an oil change, and you're not able to do that, that could prove disastrous. Because one thing would turn into another thing, which would turn losing a job, which would turn into not being able to eat, which could turn into homelessness, which, you know, and your entire, and there is no resting place for you. There is no place for you to turn. You know, one of the more humbling moments that I had was divorce. My child was with his mother, and I'm at church, and it's around Thanksgiving time, and they put a call out for a Thanksgiving dinner for those who had no place to go, and the pastor called for those who were, and I had never heard this term before, but when I thought about it, I was just like, wow, I'm fretting over things when people have things so much worse. The term was families of one. And a host of people rose, they went down to the altar, and these were people who had no living relatives, no brothers, no sisters, no cousins, no aunts, no uncles, no nothing. There was not another human being that was carrying their DNA living on the face of the planet Earth. And when you think about that situation, and then you factor in also the possibility that you're living as a family of one, and there are people out here who are your relatives, you just don't know who they are, and you don't know how to reach them, but you know that they're out there. That has to resemble a vivid nightmare. During those moments of solitude and quiet. You know, and I think that bleeds over into and seeps over into the relationships that you form. You know, what would really, to have something satisfy that, you would hold on to it with all your might, even if it wasn't good for you. Yeah, you have the other end of the spectrum where young ladies producing a baby so that they can have something to love and something that will love them.
They said 19% of the young girls who aged out were expecting. No, 17% were expecting. So that would make sense. You know that child is going to love you unconditionally, because, you know, usually that's the relationship we're born with our parents until we get a little older. Even when we are in abusive relationships with our parents, we really don't realize it until we get old enough to, you know that it's wrong. Our parents are the first example of God that we know. And it's sad. I knew a group of young people who were raising themselves, and the oldest was like 17, but they got up and they went to school, every morning until the younger ones got to the rebellious stage. But this 17-year-old had, two cousins and one sibling, and they made it. I don't know how, I don't know, where they got other resources from, if she ended up eventually being able to be emancipated. But when you hear that there are children out here raising themselves, it's totally true. They used to come to the car wash every Friday and wash cars with us for $10-$15, just to keep them engaged and keep them with a little bit of money in their pocket. So there are children who are out here actually raising themselves.
Most definitely. You know, it's a situation where, Lord knows, and that's in many ways all that you can kind of say about it. Lord knows.
So, Dr. Jones, when I'm looking at these statistics, too, it says that they spend about 2% of the federal budget on
training and, you know, recruitment and things like that, but they say that over 22% of the children never actually end up finding homes. So how can they be spending all of this money on foster care and programs and yet all these children be slipping through the cracks?
Well, I mean, you know, it would be interesting to see the breakdown of how that money is distributed. I would almost guarantee that so much of it is on administration. And, you know, you can have a $1 billion budget, but if it's not administered correctly and applied in the right areas, you might as well have only had a $10,000 budget, because you have people mm-hmm. who are going to be getting basically fat off of that. So, you know, it's a situation where, to be honest with you, we know that racism peaks at moments that we of economic downturn, economic misery, and what have you. There's no doubt about that. And I would venture to believe that economic suffering would also cause people to avoid, almost at all costs, adding another mouth to feed, another child to raise, especially when the child mm-hmm. is not there. You know, it's the lives that we live. I think that we're so busy doing what we do that who wants to bother?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to bother? So, yeah.
Yeah, we hear this term, you know, they'll be better off. You know, what determines better off? Like, you know,
yeah.
How do you determine better off?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some situations of, there's some situations in some parents out there where one is left with no other decision, and yet, you know, I wouldn't trust you raising a billy goat, let alone a kid, you know. You have those people out there.
I want to read this real quick. It says, It says adopted children make up roughly 2% of the total child population under the age of 18, but 11% of all adolescents referred for therapy have been adopted. Post-adoption services are important to all types of adoption, whether foster care, adoption, international adoption, or domestic infant adoption. So let me see. It says 2%. 11% of the adolescents referred for therapy have been adopted, you know, out of all the children, I guess, that they see per year. So this just reaffirms that statistic earlier about not getting that initial bonding, not getting that initial nurturing and care, even if it was from, you know, a father per se. You're still with that paternal parent during those most formidable years. And so, you know, these statistics, again, it's just staggering. And if you want to check these out, anybody that's listening, it's called the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute, and it is on the web. It's www.ccainstitute.org, and you can find these statistics that I'm looking at here. So, Dr. Jones, what are we as a community going to do about it, or what can we do about it? And do you recommend you know, how can you recommend that people get more involved in this particular situation?
You know, I think you asked several questions there. To be honest with you, what do I think that we're going to do about it? Nothing. Absolutely, positively nothing. We're going to have more discussions about things that don't matter and continue to miss the ball on things that actually do matter. What can we do? We can reach up and we can, for all intents and purposes, undo this problem almost overnight if we chose to. But I don't have faith that we will. You know, and that's the realistic part of me. You know, in regards to that.
Well, there are several adoption websites out here, www, AmericanAdoptions.com, and, you know, they talk about, you know, if you're facing an unplanned pregnancy, what they possibly could do to help. But, you know, Dr. Jones, I think we, I don't know, but, I mean, we can't certainly save the world, but it's almost as if, you know, we're kind of, you know, supporting the system, if you will, you know, even mentioning these websites, because we really don't know if these people are about, you know, what this fancy schmancy website says they're about. So, you know, we're even with that, we're still taking a risk, even, you know, seeking information and trying to help people.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, the thing is that I think that any, you know, concerns, any of the, a lot of these concerns that we have may need to be put down. There are certain things that, you know, we kind of say in regards to our children, you know, not before the children, that's a child, that's, you know, we need to behave as a community differently when it's our children, you know, because the thing is that there's a difference between rhetoric and real life. And how often have we heard our people talk about, well, you know, children are the future, you know, X, Y, and Z. Well, look at what our future is then, because we're not providing a world, any mechanisms, any structure that would allow that future to even have half of a chance of ever flourishing. And it's for that reason we ought to be, we should be ashamed.
Well, I would like to do a part two to this broadcast, and maybe I'm looking at this National Association of Black Social Workers website, and I'm also looking at something called the NACAC. It stands for the National Network Council on Adopted Children. Oh, I thought that one might have been. Yes, it's African American Adoption Agencies. They have a listing here of black adoption agencies that are national, are nationwide. So, you know, I really would like to do a part two to this if you'd be interested, and maybe pull in some of these black social workers and maybe some of the people from these adoption agencies to see, you know, what resource they can be for people who are out here, maybe even young girls who, you know, maybe considering abortion or adoption or, you know, having these children on their own. You know, maybe this conversation needs to begin with those kinds of people as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, without a doubt. Those are the people who are not only on the front line, but also the soldiers who have to feel that no one has their back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you think about how daunting that task must actually be in regards to getting African Americans to engage in this process of adopting. You know, because we immediately fall into the idea, man, them kids is bad. Nobody want to deal with them. You know, and those are our children. Those are someone's children. You know, and it's, you know, the thing for me is that I find it to be so disingenuous for us on the one hand to say, well, it takes a village to raise, you know, a child. Yet at the same time, when that child is needing any rearing, any day-to-day material rearing, all of a sudden the village disperses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really puts you in the mind of Does our commitment, and I'm speaking about the activist community, does our commitment cease at the moment of a little discomfort? The moment that something bothers us, do we go ahead and let the rope go and say, ah, well, you know, I tried. At least I tried,
right,
you know, to the point of a little pain. You know, but these are the discussions that our people don't want to have. They would rather have a discussion about the show Empire, about brothers being on the down low, about, you know, about something that is, in their terms, entertaining and sensational. versus the nuts and bolt daily issues that we have to deal with as a community and that we should be dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is definitely something that either, you know, that we know somebody or know or have a family member or, you know, have had a relationship with somebody that's been involved in an adoptive type of situation. All of us know somebody mm-hmm. who's been in the system some sort of way. And like you said, the more that we solidify the network, if you will, the better off our children are going to be. So I want to give out this email address to the NACAC.org contact person for African American Adoption Agencies. It's Mary Boo, MaryBoo, at NACAC.org. And just to give you one or two other organizations that are on the list, it says Black Adoption Services, Three Rivers Adoption Council. This is located in Pittsburgh. It's www.threeriversadopt.org. The Black Adoption Placement and Research Center. This is in Oakland. It's www.baprc.org. And just to give you another one, this one's in Richmond, Virginia. It says National Network of Adoption Advocacy Programs. The website is www.naap-occ.org. And I will be placing these contact agencies on Sign of the Times as well as on Dr. Jones's page on Facebook, Manhood, Race, and Culture. So, Dr. Jones, did you have anything that you wanted to make sure that we included in this broadcast? And I'm very much looking forward to doing a part two.
You know what? You know, the big thing is that, as with the piece that I wrote, ultimately when you add it up and you take away all the materialism, all the fluff, the thing that has historically resonated with our people, and it's the one thing that I would hope that we would be able to couch ourselves in, is the mantra of we all we got. And when one of us is not doing well and suffering, all of us should be bothered by it, should have some concern for it. It's sort of the mantra that Richard Pryor talked about at one of the stand-up comedians. He talked about being in Africa. This is when he announced that he would no longer use the N-word. He said he ran into an African, and the African asked him, "Who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm Richard Pryor." He said, "Who are you?" And he said, the African responded, "I am we." And I think that that needs to be the mantra. I believe that if we were to take the position of "I am we," it would reverberate and resonate across our entire lives, and we would treat each other better. And by treating each other better, we'd have more consideration for one another. And maybe it wouldn't be so difficult to get Black folk to support each other politically, economically, and to love each other socially if we adopted "I am we." So, and I'll give it back.
Ashe. Well, I think that sounds like a wonderful idea. And, you know, maybe we can incorporate that with our Black code to, you know, recite that we definitely are communal. And that's where us calling each other brother and sister came from, because when we would run into each other after slavery, we did not know if the person that we were seeing was indeed our brother or our sister. It's not solely attributed to the Black Power movement. It is because we, you know, to a certain extent, were these same adopted children lost in the wilderness throughout the diaspora. And so it's good if we take that up, Dr. Jones. And, you know, I would be all in favor of pushing that through the UAC and, you know, making that mantra happen, because we are each other's keeper, brother, sister, mother, daughter, son, uncle, cousin. We are each other's keeper. So I want to thank you for your time tonight. I want, you know, to appreciate you, because especially considering you were under the weather. So thank you. And if there's
nothing else that you would like to contribute, we can go ahead and wrap up, and then we will see everybody here tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We will see you all tomorrow at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time here on Sign of the Times. Talk to you soon. Peace.
Peace.
Work it out with me, baby.